On the phone, I have Summit County Councilmember Doug Clegg. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
So once again, the council approving a special exception, this for the Mind Gym climbing wall there at Quinn's Junction. Talk to me real quickly about why the council in favor of this. Again, very, very close vote, 3-2.
You know, the long story short is we're all in favor of the project. The question is, how does it get approved? And there is a process in our code by which people can ask for a special exception. They have to meet four criteria, and the hardest one, of course, is the unique circumstances. And by and large, normally when you interpret the code, you interpret the unique circumstances as being specific to the property that they own. In this case, the council voted to accept unique circumstances as being the type of facility that they want to build. And that's why the vote was split, essentially. It wasn't over whether we liked the climbing wall or not. We like it. We all like it. We think it's a great idea. But
so what you say is that the county needs to just amend the code.
Yeah. And this is something that I've been through before. As some of your listeners may know, I've been doing this work for 35 years. And I had a similar project in which I simply amended the code in order to allow it to happen, because that at the time seemed to be the appropriate way to do it. But in this case, while I think that everybody was agreeable with amending the code, I think that the majority of the council found that the most expedient thing to do was to give them a special exception and not make them wait around for a code amendment.
Yeah, and as you noted yesterday, the Geneva Rock Products did get a height exception, but because they...
No, it wasn't actually... No, that actually... We amended the code for Geneva Rock Products.
Okay.
And that was exactly the point that I was making, was that Geneva Rock Product could not qualify for a special exception, and that's why I was their consultant at the time, and that's why we amended the code.
Yeah, council also allowed that height exception for the Woodward. Again, would that have worked better if the code had just been amended somehow, and what would that look like?
Well, what you need to do is you need to define certain uses for which height exceptions can be granted, or additional height is allowed in the code. I shouldn't say exceptions. They're allowed in the code. And maybe Woodward was one of those examples. I wasn't on the council at the time that Woodward got approved, but perhaps that's the way it should have been, or the building should have been buried in the ground more, that's all.
Yeah. Taking a look then at the, good draw for the Bittner connector road there between
right.
Silver Creek and Bittner Ranch Road. You didn't make a decision. You say that this, you will take it up again in November, and that even though you had a plea from one resident saying they need more time. Why can't you wait? You've waited this long.
I think that some of the council felt that we've been working on this for, 5 or 10 years, and this is something that we need to move forward because it is an essential life safety and welfare issue, and there was some sense of needing to do this expeditiously.
All right. Did you hear the crowd favor any particular option?
No, the crowd is mixed based on, essentially where you live. Obviously, if you live down in the Woodside Homes, down near the freeway, you don't want the frontage road up against your property. And if you live further up, you don't want the frontage road coming through your neighborhood. Those are not unexpected feelings by the public. We're, you know, the, that that was not a surprise to council. That's really kind of the long and the short of it.
Yeah.
I think most people realize that there's a need for secondary access. We feel that there's a need for that road if we're ever to get bus traffic out there. We feel that there's a need for that road to provide better emergency services in terms of, you know, ambulance and fire, you know, as well as evacuation on those somewhat rare events when there is a problem in the overall subdivision and people need to leave.
Yeah. What about the suggestion, though, that it only be limited to emergency and transit, and that it would be closed to any kind of through traffic? Is that acceptable to you?
Well, it's certainly something that we'll look at. You know, it was something that I noted. The summary, however, is that the road will be and is anticipated to draw a lot of traffic because there is a physical need for a frontage road. For those of you who take that exit onto 40, you'll often find that it's backed all the way up to the Kimball Junction. So there is simply a capacity issue there. And our studies show that there would be a large amount of usage on this frontage road because people don't want to necessarily have to get on the freeway in order to go to Kimball Junction.
Yeah. And a few speakers talked about a tunnel under I-80. Let's talk a little bit about that because, again, with all of the development happening there across the highway, the Silver Creek Village with the proposed mixed-use area for that marketplace, Henry Siggs development, doesn't it make more sense just to have the traffic go that way as opposed back to Kimball?
Well, I don't know that it makes more sense. It may be one of the possible solutions, but the problem with the tunnel under Highway 80 is that it's tens of millions of dollars. It's maybe $20-30 million to try and put a tunnel under I-80. And then you have to ask the question, where do you get to? Well, you don't get to the essential services that you want in Kimball Junction, which is what would be driving a significant amount of traffic out of the area. It does allow you to get into Park City through 248, but that's not our goal. 248 is already at failing level.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking 20 years down the line when a lot of that is developed. So you're just saying we need to get to Kimball first because that's where everything is?
Well, it's not that we need to get there first. It's that it's the logical place to get to. That's where
for
fire
now.
Is. That's where ambulance is. That's where the bulk of our retail is. Will Silver Creek eventually have some retail in it? You know, yes. But that may be decades in the future.
Yeah.
And it's not the same sort of hub. You know, we're in the process of revisiting the Kimball Junction master plan. We've done that at the general plan level. We're in the process of revisiting it as a specific revision right now for the purposes of making it a better functioning neighborhood.
So as a planner and at this point, are you leaning towards the frontage road, the church road, or something else?
I have major concerns about both. The new, what we refer to as the Bittner alternative, I'm not particularly thrilled with because of the impacts on the neighborhood. But we're in a situation where any solution that we come up with will have some significant impacts on the neighborhoods.
All right. So again, do you expect to make a decision in November? Or do we need?
I don't think that the November meeting is talked about in terms of making a decision. Specifically because we asked the various people involved in the neighborhoods to come back to us with their best ideas. So, you know, I wouldn't expect there to be a final decision at that meeting. We're going to take that information and look at it and evaluate it, and we're not going to do it over the dais. You know, this is not a matter of trying to dismiss ideas. This is a matter of trying to get the best idea.
And other business, the independent audit for 2018 completed. The representative from the Ulrich and Associates, the auditor, said that the county was over budget in some general fund spending on transportation projects. Is that at all concerning, or is that just fiscal timing?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's the latter. It happens when, you know, we have a budget year, right? And so we budgeted certain expenditures on transportation for 2018, and we didn't get them all spent. So some of them moved over into 2019. So it is, as you noted, just a question of timing.
You also heard from the landowner committee representing the Cedar Crest Village Overlay at Hoytsville. They had a particular ask. They want the county to ask UDOT to add a possible interchange at Creamery Lane to the STIP list. This is known as the Transportation Infrastructure Program. Is that something right. that you'll do?
No, I think our response to them was positive, that, you know, we feel if their project goes forward that an interchange would be appropriate. But they're very much at the beginning stages of they can't even tell us how many units they're asking for at this point. You know, they've just got a bubble diagram, which is appropriate. That's what they should be doing. But we don't even know at this point how much traffic they're going to generate.
So the idea is that it goes to East County Planning Commission and then back before you would consider making a request?
It has a fairly long road to go in front of them right now. Again, they're at bubble diagram level, and they don't even know what sort of density they're going to be requesting. So they, as a committee, need to come up with their strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and constraints and work through those things. And I think they're just at the very beginning of that process.
Okay, I was going to say, I mean, if they think they need something like this, they must have some idea of the numbers.
Well, those were the questions that we asked them, and the answer was, no, we don't, but we think it's a lot. A lot is not necessarily a term that you're going to come up with in a code. You're not going to say, yeah, this is great for a lot of development. So they need to get more specific. But on the concept overall of whether there would be an interchange there, you know, the interchanges in that area are 8 miles apart. The general design standard is that you have them no closer than a mile apart. So there's plenty of room for an appropriate interchange in there. So, you know, of that, I think we're generally supportive. I think that's what we told them.
Yeah. Also, the Weber River runs through this area. Any impacts that the village could have on the river?
Well, that was my biggest concern. My biggest concern about the project entirely is that the Weber River is out of compliance with federal water quality standards. And the county is largely responsible for cleaning up the Weber River, because most of the impacts are land use impacts. And so if we're going to permit a new project in that area, it is going to have to be designed to the highest standard for stormwater management that that currently exists. And so my point to them was, this is not going to look like your grandfather's subdivision. This is going to look like an entirely appropriate stormwater management system that is not anything we've seen in the county. We just haven't had any big development since the laws have changed.
Okay, Doug, anything else that you'd like to mention?
I think that's it. Leslie, thank you very much.
It's 8:30 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, after a year of data collection and analysis by stakeholders, experts, and community members, the Park City Community Foundation has identified three priority issues within social equity and has recommendations for addressing them. Joining me in the studio now to explain what is in the Social Equity Strategic Plan, I have the Community Foundation Social Equity Director, Diego Zagara, along with Community Impact Director, Ollie Wilder. Good morning.
Good morning.
Buenos días, Leslie.
Yeah, so from the Social Equity Community Survey and different conversations with the community, you've identified affordable housing, education, and inclusion as issues of high interest and ones where some prompt action can be taken. These aren't one-dimensional issues, however. Diego, maybe explain what you think you can address within each of those.
Sure. I think you're spot on when you say that they're all interconnected issues, and they all impact how folks experience our community. Housing, education, and under the education umbrella, we're putting a big emphasis on early childhood education as well as inclusion. That's what the community was telling us they were feeling were pain points, so to speak, areas where they were experiencing disparities. And at the same time, we felt as a group, the advisory committee and other task forces, that those were three areas that we were well positioned for impact. I can talk a little bit about the tactics that we're thinking about.
Yeah, we can talk about that in just a minute. But are these racial differences? Are these income, economic differences? Do we see a split, or is it that everybody in this economic bracket feels this way, or everybody in that culture class feels that way?
I'd say it's pretty spread. I think that there are some markers for disparities, but a lot of folks, regardless of socioeconomic background, race, gender, are feeling those disparities.
Okay. So in terms of the inclusion, this is kind of a little floaty philosophical feeling. I mean, how do you change that?
That's a good question, and it's one that we've wrestled with as well, right? I think that historically we haven't been the greatest at including all voices at the table. I'll admit that in the nonprofit world and in other circles, we have an excellent group of folks at the table, a qualified, successful group of folks, and sometimes the voices that we're missing are the voices of the people that are experiencing the disparities. Inclusion speaks to that, not just to who's at the table, but who has a voice and who has the ability to enact policy change, set strategy, and be involved in the decision-making process. I think that inclusion speaks to that.
Yeah. Part of inclusion, though, is just showing up. But part of the problem is that when you're working two or three jobs, you don't have time to show up.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
So where do you get that input then? If they're choosing to have two or three jobs because they are not choosing, I guess they're kind of forced to. Can you have it both ways?
I think we can. So the way we see it is that because we are valuing inclusion, it's making us think about our processes in a different way. If we are valuing those voices being at the table, then how do we interact with those voices, and where do we have to meet them to make that happen? Maybe the way we've always done things is not the best way. If we are valuing inclusion, we ought to think about the processes that are in place and the systems that exist currently that are leaving those voices out.
So are we talking about places when and where we meet?
When and where we meet, how we communicate. I think those are all variables that we are considering in being more inclusive.
Okay, so how will you know if you've been successful there?
That's a great question, and that's a big one. I think that we do have some less, let's say, some qualitative pieces in place that we hope to be able to better track into the future, but I think that one of the easiest ways to see if we're being... Diversity is something that we think about when we think about inclusion, but it's not the end-all be-all, because a group could be diverse but not necessarily inclusive. I think that the inclusion piece is particularly hard to measure, and it's something that we are learning more about each day.
Yeah, and then it's just so personal and different for everyone, whether or not they feel included, yeah?
Yes, you're right. Because you and I and Ollie feel included doesn't necessarily mean that everyone does. And that's the tricky part about it.
There are some things we could ask again. For example, in the community social equity survey that we did, we asked whether people had a lack of feeling included as something that was a major social equity issue. And that was identified by people across all incomes. It was very interesting. And I think when we go back and do a similar survey 2-3 years from now, whenever that is, that's a question we can look at and say, is that improving? Are fewer people saying that that's a big issue? Another thing is, at least just in terms of diversity, you can look at what's the diversity of boards and leadership committees and things like that around the community. And I think one of the things we hope to do is create a kind of a leadership campaign where we're encouraging people and helping give them tools to diversify and make their processes more inclusive. And we can actually ask people how many people in these different groups or communities serve on your board and try to pull that together and see how that changes over time.
Yeah, but does it even need to be that high level? I mean, there's so many other leadership issues. I mean, whether it's Girl Scouts or soccer coaching or, you know, things like that.
I think it doesn't just have to be leadership. One of the things that's in the plan is things like living room conversations. It's how do we just get to know each other in our community? How do we expose ourselves to people who we might not be used to hanging around with? And I think some of that can be done in organized ways, and some of it is just raising awareness and encouraging people to give it a try.
Yeah. And at the same time, I know that when we have talked about doing a teen center, it's like teenagers saying, no, that's not what we want. So, well, again, are we kind of like saying, oh, this is how you feel inclusive by coming here? I mean, are people going to push that away?
Well, one of the interesting things about that teen survey that was done and what teens say is the bigger question is, hey, teens, what would you like? And how can we get you in the driver's seat of making that happen? That's a great example of a group where we can be more inclusive in terms of what are the voices that are helping make decisions that affect their lives. So that's really what we want to be looking for. And it's a challenge. It's not going to be that easy. It's something we have to learn how to do.
Yeah. And I think of the three, that seems the most difficult. The other two almost can be taken care of with money, right?
Well, not necessarily affordable housing. It's not just money. It's also about process and what people say and what they feel about what their neighborhood's going to be like. So really what we've identified in the plan is less about money around affordable housing and more around advocacy, around encouraging the public officials to make the processes as conducive to affordable housing as possible, and then also just the mechanics of connecting people with the opportunities that do exist, centralizing some of the information and outreach so people know what the opportunities are, and so we know who could really use the housing. So some of it's more around advocacy and around organizing ourselves.
So who takes that on? I mean, I thought that was kind of what Mountainlands Community Housing was kind of doing, was the gathering place for all affordable housing.
They will likely continue to play a key role in that, and hopefully an expanded role. And there are other actors in the community as well, such as Habitat and for that matter, the city and the county who are deeply involved in this. And I think right now, as we move into the implementation phase of the strategic plan, we're starting to organize, okay, how do we fund these things? Who coordinates them? And the city is probably going to step up with some social equity special service contracts in the near future that may focus on some of these areas. And at that point, it'll emerge, okay, who's best placed to actually do it?
Yeah. The plan also mentions income, access to health care, and transportation as kind of the next tier of social equity issues. Why didn't those make the top tier?
We felt collectively that those were areas that we were not as well positioned to address, although we did want to include them in the plan to reflect what the community was telling us. Back to something you said at the beginning, these are all interconnected. It's hard to talk about one without addressing the other. And those are conversations that we would like to have in the future, although the plan does focus on affordable housing, education, and inclusion.
The city has recently started its 2020 visioning process, and we pulled up the results of that survey. And the very first answer to the question, what does a perfect future for Park City look like, says, less governmental social engineering, specifically around affordable housing, inclusion, and diversity. So you, of course, the Community Foundation, has worked very closely with Park City Municipal on this. How much of the social equity efforts should fall to local government?
That's a good question. I think the answer is that this is a community effort. It's I think the city is playing a role, but at the core, it's a group of folks that the Community Foundation has convened and is leading the process on letting us know what does the community need for for us to close disparities. The government has a role to play. I think the for-profit sector has a role to play. And I think that the nonprofit sector or philanthropy has a role to play in addressing these challenges. So what we're doing is setting the table for that conversation to take place.
And of course, nothing is possible without the funding to support it. The City Council, again, provided, I think, a $100,000 grant to Community Foundation, partly to pay for your work, Diego. What does the strategic plan talk about in future years?
In terms of funding, I think the city will continue to support certain aspects of the plan, but there are others that, as Diego pointed out, may feel more like community responsibilities. Interesting example where we're a few steps ahead is early childhood. And we've developed a sort of early draft of a five-year plan to help increase access to childcare and to early childhood education, support for parents and caregivers, just elevating the importance of that in the community. We're actually currently trying to raise $1 million to cover the first 2 years of activity of that five-year plan. And we've already raised over $700,000 toward that. So behind the scenes, we've already been doing some early work, at least on some of these issues. Now, that one is definitely ahead of the others, but it's a great example and kind of an inspiration for how we might approach some of these other things. Yes, let's get government behind it, but yes, let's get business and philanthropy and the community in general behind it. And we're all going to have to roll up our sleeves on this.
Yeah. Well, Park City, though, has put $40 million towards affordable housing. So, I mean, that's a huge step.
It's a huge step, and we're really encouraged by that. And I think, as we mentioned earlier, it's not always money that's the issue. Sometimes it's process and community support and just people connecting to the opportunities.
So now that the strategic plan has outlined the next steps to take, how do social equity efforts roll out from here?
So the conversation continues on each of those areas as the Community Foundation continues to set the table for those to take place. We launch the plan next week. Right? It's sort of a celebration of what's transpired over the last year of us bringing over 100 different stakeholders to the table to discuss these issues. And Leslie, you're invited, of course, next Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. at Legacy Lodge. But I think that right now our role is, how do we make this plan happen? How do we find the funding and where do we go for some of these interventions to start taking place? And we have some good ideas. Early childhood was an example of.
And we do have task forces that have been created as part of the planning process. So there now is an affordable housing task force that can now turn its attention to, okay, how do we get it done? Now we figured out what, let's go do it. There's an early childhood alliance that's been formed. We've got an inclusion task force. So basically we've got some people ready to roll on this. But again, we need money and we need to really get moving.
Okay, so this launch party, everyone's invited?
Yes, visit our website for more details and please RSVP, parkcitycf.org.
Okay, guys, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:44. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now in studio, I have Jenny Dearson, Special Events Manager. Good morning.
Good morning.
Another busy weekend, I should say. We're going to kind of kick it off. We got a song festival. We've got Autumn Aloft. Silly Sunday still going on, so I'll let you take it off with Autumn Aloft and the plans there.
Well, the Autumn Aloft is returning for now the sixth season. That'll be on Saturday and on Sunday. That event is at the North 40 Field, so over by the school district. I think this is a great event to bring out the community and the family and check it out. It is supposed to be beautiful this weekend. They feature about 24 hot air balloons that'll be launching from that field. The launch is around 8 a.m. In the morning, and that should last. They're there until about 11 o'clock, but it usually is about a two-hour event out there in the morning. I do want to remind folks that this is an event where we do see a bit of traffic on 248 in particular. So please, if you're attending the event, especially if you're here local in town, think about taking the bus to the event or riding your bike. And if you are in a car, please carpool out to that venue specifically.
What bus do you need to be on to get dropped off there?
So the best bus to actually take to the school district is either the Old Town Transit Center. If you live up in Deer Valley, there's also a bus that leaves there early that'll get you to the school district before the launch. And I believe that those leave about every 20 minutes. So the first one here in Old Town, I believe, is at 7:15 a.m.
So is that the red bus or the...
That is the red bus, and I would have to check on the yellow, but that's the best one to catch there.
Okay. What else? We've got, again, no parking along the sides of the street and no residential parking.
So. Yeah, so those signs will be posted. And just please be careful in the school district area. The construction is still going on in that area, so just be aware of that in particular. And then also specifically on Saturday night, the candlestick or the glow is on Main Street between 4th and 5th Street. That's a great event to come out and enjoy the shops and restaurants on Main Street and get to really interact very closely with the balloonists that are here in town. I do want to remind folks, if you are coming to Main Street, whether for Autumn Aloft or to just enjoy town on Saturday, traffic will change on 5th Street because it's now going the other direction. So you'll just see that traffic detour if you're in the Main Street area. So just a heads up on that one as well.
Okay. And then we've got a new event. This is the Singer-Songwriter Festival. That's kicking off Friday afternoon.
Yeah, so Friday and Saturday, the Singer-Songwriter Festival is beginning here in Park City. This is five venues on Main Street that are hosting world-renowned folk, country, rock, and soul artists. There is quite a lineup, and this is quite an opportunity for our community. Tickets are available, and if you can just go onto their website to check out all the opportunities. But really a great new event starting here in Park City, bringing some artists that are pretty incredible to Park City.
Yeah, and you're not thinking the impacts are going to be that great, except for perhaps Saturday night when we see the Balloon Festival, in combination with
some of the activities going on, we'll probably see some increased business on Main Street. The events are a little bit later in the evening to kind of complement the event that's already going on. But again, just a great opportunity if you want to come and hang out in the evening. And then, yes, we just have a couple of silly markets left. I believe it's this weekend and next weekend. Again, it's supposed to be beautiful out, so it's a great time to ride your bike to that event and come check out the market. HPCA is also hosting a new event on a couple of Sundays and throughout the fall. They're bringing some local musicians and artists and performers to the street, so as you're out here shopping and coming to restaurants in the shoulder season, you can see some of those local artists on the street while you're shopping around. And then one of my personal favorites is Tour de Suds, and that's back on Sunday as well. They'll leave South City Park and head up Main Street before they hit the trails and come back down. It's just a great event to kind of celebrate the end of the summer and the beginning of the fall out on the trails.
Okay. Again, that you do close traffic along Park Avenue and Main Street for that?
That's a rolling road closure. Mm-hmm. So at 10 o'clock when that race starts, we see, again, it's a rolling closure. So as soon as they go by, it's back open. But there's about a 20-minute delay in there, both on Park Avenue as well as Main Street.
Okay. So if you need to get somewhere, take Deer Valley Drive.
That would be the best plan. Yes. Thanks.
Okay. And then just a quick update of what we've got coming to look forward to.
Yep. So really quick, Leslie, I just want to thank you so much for having me on the radio and getting the information out to the community and really the community for all their work and helping us gather feedback. We do have some events coming up in the near future. So Scarecrow Festival, the Park City Wine Festival, Shot Ski, and Halloween are still some events out there. And this is one of our busiest times for trail events. So I want to remind folks we are working closely with Charlie. But if you want to know about trail unpacks, it's always best to go to mountaintrails.org and figure those out. And I know he's on the radio rather frequently as well.
Okay. Jenny, thanks.
Thank you.
Jenny Dearson, Park City Municipal Special Events Manager. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:50. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, joined now in the studio by Emily Fisher, Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director, and the Alliance's Development Director, Jana Dalton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Emily, let's start with you. We have kicked off our after-school programs that YSA sponsors.
Yes, the Get Out and Play programs start tomorrow, Friday, on the early release day for all of the elementary schools, Ecker, Silver Summit, and South Summit, and then on Monday for Treasure Mountain.
Okay, those are all full?
Well, they're not all full. We do have some spots open for rowing and mountain biking at Treasure Mountain on Mondays. So if anybody is interested in those programs, they can just sign up on our website, ysaparkcity.org.
Okay, and what, there's a minimal charge for each of these? Or?
Yeah, we do have, there is a charge because sometimes we provide, like for the rowing program, we provide transportation, so that is a big expense in our overall budget. So there is a charge for these, but we also have a scholarship rate for those that can't afford the programs. So it's just a nominal commitment fee.
Okay, how do you get that information? I mean, we were just having this conversation about inclusion.
Yes.
So people who listen to the radio know about the programs. People
yes.
who don't listen to the radio may not know about it. So how else do you get out that word?
Yeah, and that's where we work with Heather Sims, works with all of the outreach coordinators at each school, and she goes to all of the back-to-school nights. We translate all of our materials into Spanish. We work really closely with those outreach coordinators to see, do they have target students they think would benefit from our programs? How can we get the word out? We go to work with the Solomon program for sign-up nights. So we have a lot of different ways that we communicate with all parts of our community to make sure that anyone who wants to try any of these programs has the opportunity. And we shoot to scholarship 25% of all of our programs. So working hard to include everybody.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the Silver Summit Academy, this is part of the South Summit School District.
Yep.
They're joining the Get Out and Play and Activate program. So that's new and an additional expense
yep,
for you guys.
Yep, that's a new school. And they can join any of our Get Out and Play and Activate programs. And we've also expanded our programs in the South Summit School District. So last year we were in a pilot program with just one option, and this year we'll have two or three per session.
Yeah. You seen some good turnout then from South Summit?
Yeah, absolutely. Our first year we had 20% of the school participate, and we've had just a really great response because they have very limited after-school programs out there and working closely with the superintendent out there. So it's been great.
Okay. The SNOW program registration hasn't happened yet, though?
It has not opened yet, so keep an eye on our website. That usually opens mid-October for all of our ski and ice programs. So we have sort of early winter programs, and then late winter programs, so you can try several different winter sports.
Okay. You're also going to be handing out the Live Like Sam YSA Gratitude Grants. What's this?
So this is a new partnership. We are partnering with the Live Like Sam Foundation to give our first gratitude grants. These are merit-based scholarships. Our Stein Erickson Endowment is for athletes that are in our seven winter sports clubs. They are all need-based. But we wanted to do something for the athletes that maybe don't have the need but are showing great gratitude and sportsmanship in the community. We wanted to be able to recognize those athletes and give them some sort of recognition for their awesome sportsmanship and their gratitude. So working with the Live Like Sam Foundation, these are for any students 8 to 18 in Summit and Wasatch County that display sportsmanship and gratitude could apply for those. And we had a really great response, and we were intending to give out about five, and we're going to give out 11. So, and those will be awarded at our Circle of Excellence event on September 29th.
Okay, so we're not releasing the winners yet? Do they know?
They know,
oh,
yes.
Good.
Yep, so that's exciting.
Okay, and then it wasn't just an application. They actually had to think about it.
They had to think about it. There was an application process. They wrote an essay. They also had four thank you notes that they had to show us, and they did a small video. So it was definitely a little bit of a process to make sure that these are the athletes who are really showing gratitude and sportsmanship.
Okay. And Jan, let's turn to you. Jan's winner welcome. We've got some tickets left?
We do. We are about 6 weeks away. The event is October the 26th. And yes, we do have tickets and table sponsorships still available. Tickets are available for $375 per person. And then we have table sponsorships beginning at $4,000 for a table for 10. You can go online to our website at ysaparkcity.org to actually purchase your tickets if you're interested. It's a great kickoff event to winter, and all proceeds go back to the seven winter sports clubs and our scholarship program. So it's definitely an event that you don't want to miss out on.
Okay, and then for people who do not come to the evening, they still have an opportunity to be part of that drawing?
Absolutely. They can still purchase opportunity drawing tickets. Our grand prize this year is a Greek island cruise for two. It's on a 148-passenger sail ship, so it's a little different from your traditional large cruise line. And they can go online, purchase opportunity drawing tickets, and designate which club they would like the proceeds to go back to, as well as the athlete. They can give credit to the athlete. And 100% of those drawing ticket sales do go back to the winter sports clubs.
Okay. And this is your biggest fundraiser of the year as
well,
right?
It is. It's really important. You know, we provide the platform for the event, and the great thing about it is all seven winter sports clubs participate, and 100% of the proceeds of what they bring in goes directly back to their programs. So it's a great way to support our local athletes. Also, you know, a portion of it goes back to our scholarship program. So it's just a great way to be involved and support our athletes in town.
Okay. People are interested in tickets, YSA?
Yes, they can go directly to our website, ysaparkcity.org, and tickets for the event as well as the opportunity drawing are available.
Right. And then finally wanted to mention next month, so save the date, October 10th. It's the Give Back Night. What's happening here?
Yes, we've partnered with Versante, which is a fabulous local restaurant in town located at the Peaks Hotel. They are very generous and have done some Give Back Nights for us in the past. They're doing one again on October the 10th, so it's a great night to just take your family to dinner and give back to YSA.
Okay, so a portion of the proceeds come?
Yes, 25% goes back to YSA.
Okay, anything else?
I think that's it. Yeah, just a very busy time for us with programs kicking off and then Jan's Winter Welcome in 6 weeks.
Okay. Emily Fisher, Jana Dalton with Youth Sports Alliance. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank